So when I'm on the chief's office, I know that there's a little bit of eye roll because I'm always pushing. I always have ideas. I'm always trying to come up with creative solutions. And that's because I'm hopeful for this organization. I'm hopeful for this community. It's not because I need the work or I want the work. It's I feel a sense of responsibility to that value in me that we lived, that gave us some purpose during Sam's sickness, and I want to, you know, continue.
Thanks for joining us for the Portland Police Bureau's Talking Beat. I'm Sergeant Kevin Allen. Today on the Talking Beat, Terry Wallow Strauss of the Strategic Communications Unit has a conversation with Chief Bob Day. It's a chance for us to speak with the chief about some meaningful topics, including why he came out of retirement to head the Bureau, the many changes he's seen over the course of his career, how the death of his son has changed his outlook on life, and how he's using these personal and professional experiences to lead the Bureau forward with hope. Now, let's jump into the show.
Thanks for being here today, Chief. So the first question I have for you is you and I worked together for a long time. Mm-hmm. You left. I think we had a cake, some mm-hmm. kind of retirement ceremony, and then you chose to come back. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your reasons for coming back, and how is the Bob Day now different from the Bob Day that left in 2019?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Coming back, I get a lot of questions about that. You know, why would I come back? Why would I leave retirement? I think I really did enjoy being retired. It's a gift that we have in this profession to be able to retire young, relatively speaking. And I just always encourage cops anywhere around the country that I would see. I would always tell them, take care of yourself physically, emotionally, mentally, financially, so that you can retire when it's time. And I'm really grateful for that. But, you know, why did I come back? Well, really, this was not on the radar at all. It came completely out of left field. Conversation that I had with Chuck, conversations I had with the mayor. And after speaking with both of them and then just seeing what was going on in the community and believing that we're sort of uniquely poised right now, this time period, as an organization and as a city, to really lead maybe this region, maybe this state in a way that could really make a difference. And, you know, I'm a public servant at heart, always have loved the city and loved the police bureau. So what really inspired me was to see the diverse amount of people that are really leaning in this conversation, like I have never seen in my career. I started in 1990. We're seeing whether it's the business community, whether it's social service providers and the state and the city and the county and just all across the board, you know, communities of color, on and on and on, engaging and wanting to see Portland be better. I think we recognize that, we've definitely lost a step or two in the last few years. And the collective desire to see us be better really inspired me and thought, well, if I can be a part of that and the police bureau can be a part of that, and leadership has confidence that I can maybe help with that, then I want to do it. So that's really my motivation is to try and just help us continue to mature and grow and be effective in what we do and encourage the community we serve.
So what were you doing in retirement?
Yeah, so the first 6 months I really did very little besides exercise and work on my golf game, and somewhere along those time period, my beautiful wife said to me one day, you know, our marriage does better when you're working. So that was a little bit of an indication that, retiring early and having a spouse that works full time, didn't really anticipate that adjustment. And I'd always thought that I would probably continue to work, but then I really kind of enjoyed not working. So reflected on that, and then in 2020, I was asked to come back by then Chief Resch and Mayor Wheeler to work on the closure of the Hooper Detox Center. And I was really specific and clear with both of them that I did not want to be involved in law enforcement per se. I didn't want to be seen as somebody who was, trying to, be back in the Bureau after having retired. But, Hooper Detox, I think, was a critical service for our members and for our community, and it going away certainly had a big impact. So the mayor asked me to be project manager on that, and I agreed. Well, you know, 2 weeks after I started, COVID hit, so the city shut down. And what I was dealing with was certainly a public health issue, but paled in comparison to COVID. So it was kind of difficult to get people on the phone to talk about Hooper when the world was dealing with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And then in May, when George Floyd was killed and, you know, the city began to really struggle, I remember clearly it was on a Saturday, and the chief of staff called me at home and said, hey, you know, we could really use some help around public policy and policing. And I know you don't really want to do a ton about that, but you do have some experience. So that's when Robert King was over there as the public safety advisor. So then I spent most of 2020, you know, trying to work with the policy team, you know, advising, looking at different, you know, things that were coming out of the mayor's office, trying to provide counsel. At the end of 2020, I had a great conversation with the mayor, but just told him I wasn't interested in sticking around. That's a whole other podcast to talk about the learning experience. And from that side of the street, you know, after 30 years or 29 years on this side, and to be on the other side of the street and see what was happening. And then in 21, I started my own consulting business and basically just built from the ground up with no prior experience, consulting, public speaking, training company that, you know, it's just kind of the world according to Bob Day. Ended up doing a lot of work around racial social justice with police and criminal justice agencies, doing work, continued work on the behavioral health end of things around a Hooper Docs replacement and other projects. And then been doing about the last year and a half leadership keynote addresses, speaking to private and public organizations about leadership and some of the qualities that I hope I display in my leadership and that I think are effective in managing change and challenges. So that's kind of where I was up to before I came back.
Let's talk a little bit about your career here. You know, I know that you meet with young officers, I shouldn't say young, but new officers all the time. Does it take you back to when you started, and how are things different?
Yeah, well, they are young. I mean, I'm going to be speaking this Friday at the graduation at the Basic Academy, myself and Superintendent Cotting for the OSP PPB class. And the last time I stood and spoke at a DPSST event was in June of 1990 when I was the class speaker for my graduating class. And my guess is there probably won't be a recruit on that stage who was born when I gave that speech in June of 1990, right? So There might be a few, but, you know, I mean, I love the Portland Police Bureau, and I'm passionate about this profession. And there's probably maybe two choices I made in my life that I feel really good about, and one is the woman I decided to marry, and the other is going into police work. I mean, this profession has just fit me like a glove. I love it, and I've always believed in it, and I'm tremendously proud to be a Portland police officer. So when I meet newer officers, it's just an encouragement to me. You know, there's a part of me that does cringe a little bit because I know they have a hard road ahead of them. This is a tough job. It's a tough job on the person, the individual. It's a tough job on families. There's a lot that we ask and expect. And being in this chair has been different. Even though I've held every rank in the organization now, you know, supervisory rank in the organization, this, you know, sitting in this chair and feeling that sense of sort of responsibility that I have for, you know, 1,100 personnel, more or less, in the both sworn and professional side. So when I meet these, particularly people come in the profession, I'm so excited and I'm encouraged and hopeful and I love their enthusiasm. I love going to the graduation. I love spending time with them in training. But there's also a part of me that wishes I could kind of prepare them for the next 25 years that I know is going to be filled with a lot of ups and downs and challenges, but also great opportunities to really make a difference. And it sounds a little corny, but it really is true. We are public servants and we do make a difference. And so I'm really hopeful for the people I see coming in the door. The final thing I'd say about that is I don't think I could get hired today. Like, I go to these hiring ceremonies and the resumes of these new recruits are just impressive. I mean, you know, when they were taking anybody and everybody back in the 90s, you know, I didn't even have an associate's degree. I just came on board as a 21-year-old kid, probably 3 or 4 years before they should have hired me, and figured it out. And I just stand there today amazed at people's background, diversity, work history, personal life stories. It's really, really impressive.
You talked about the ups and downs and, you know, as a professional level, but and challenges, but you've had those personally too. And I know you've been really public about the death of your son. Mm-hmm. And why don't you talk about, for those who don't know, kind of like what you went through and some of the things that you've learned since then.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have two kids, Natalie. She was born in 99, right as I was promoting to sergeant. And then Sam was born in 01 when I was a sergeant on Southeast Nights. And, you know, we were doing all the typical family stuff that you do when you're raising kids and trying to work night shift or work off hours. And, you know, I finally told Lorna she could quit trying to keep the kids quiet during the day. It didn't really matter. I was not getting any sleep either way. So after a few years on nights, went to days and, you know, began to adjust to that and being more of a traditional family. In 2010, at age 9, Sam was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, which is a rare bone cancer. Impacts about 300 folks a year, primarily young adolescents. You can get it as an adult, but it's really, really rare. But solid tumor cancers, sarcomas as they're known, you know, are pretty treatable when it comes to chemo, radiation, or removing them through surgery. So, you know, the frontline therapy for his treatment was 9 months of intense chemotherapy, a lot of time up at OHSU. I was a central precinct commander. When he was first diagnosed, I was a training division commander, was a commander position, then captain commander, and then was at central precinct through most of his diagnosis. So he had extensive treatment up there, and then they did surgery to remove the tumor from his left fibula, the bone right below the knee, the back of the calf there. But they weren't able to get it all, so then his leg was amputated below the knee. So then after that, in 2011, he adjusted to prosthetic. We had about a year of remission, and then the cancer came back in his right foot in 2012. And that required another resection, so we cut out part of his foot. He wanted to save a few toes, so he saved 3 toes, lost his big toe and the other one. But he told me one time we were contemplating how to address this tumor in his foot. He says, well, I still want to be able to wiggle some toes in the sand. So we made the decision to just take what was required versus the whole foot. He said later in life that he probably wished he would have just taken the whole foot because being an amputee was easier than being kind of partial amputee. 80% of your weight or so is carried on your big toe, and not having that, his foot was really fragile. But it was sweet in terms of just going through that process and trying to understand what to do. He was involved in all the conversations about his treatment. And then the cancer returned in 2014 in his lungs, and that was really when it became just so difficult to deal with. You can only use radiation so much. You can only do chemo so much. You can only do, cut stuff out so much. And as it grew in his lungs, ultimately, we lost him on August 27th, 2016, to what would be respiratory failure, but essentially, you know, the tumors just inhibiting the breathing in his lungs. And so, you know, I tell people that, you know, the loss of a child is certainly unique. I mean, we're not supposed to outlive our kids, and the loss of a child is just nothing that any parent should have to go through. But a couple things that I've learned along that route is, you know, grief is grief, and loss is loss. And whether it's a child, whether it's a divorce, whether it's a bankruptcy, you know, whether it's a parent, a sibling, you know, grief is very individual. And it's not anybody's place to tell me how to grieve the loss of my son, and it's certainly not my place to tell anybody how to grieve their loss, regardless of, you know, whether it's, a child or whatever that loss is loss. So I think, you know, giving myself that grace and giving other people that grace has helped me, to kind of walk through life a little differently. Prior to the loss of Sam, I was, you know, probably a lot more certain about things than I am now. You know, I had maybe more of an attitude of certitude, as we say, you know, in terms of, you know, sort of how this is how the world works. This is how you go through, you do this, you do this. This is how outcomes play out. And realizing that, you know, life isn't fair. The opening line to One of my favorite books, A Road Less Traveled, Dr. Peck says the first three words are life is difficult. Life is difficult. And then when you read the first two paragraphs of that book, is spoiler alert, but basically is once you learn life is difficult, it's not that difficult. His whole concept is like basically if you just accept the fact that life is difficult, life is hard, then maybe it'll be a little more reasonable or a little more tolerable. And so I think, you know, a big takeaway around grief, a big takeaway around, you know, life doesn't always work out like you planned and like you hoped. And then a big takeaway about, you know, how do you move forward, right? The analogy I used that helped me, or metaphor, whatever it might be, I kind of see life as like a freeway, right? We're just on it and we're just going. And then something like that happens of that magnitude and you just sort of stop. You get off the freeway and you just stop. Because you have to. You just cannot keep driving. But the reality is you got to get back on that freeway at some point. Like, I can't call the bank and say I'm not going to pay my mortgage next month because my son died. Like, you know, that sounds sad, but you got to pay your mortgage at some point. Like, you know, you have a choice to make. You're either going to get back on that freeway or not. And ultimately, you know, through community, through faith, through my own resilience, through family, whatever that needs to be, you know, finding a way to, you know, get up in the morning, put your feet on the floor and decide, you know, today's the day that I'm going to try and just take a few steps and get a little farther. And Lorna said it best. She said, you know, we never, ever lose the pain, but you gain the strength to carry the pain. So, you know, it's been 7.5 years. Every August 27th, we try to get away and go somewhere beautiful and go for a hike or spend time together and just reflect. And we love to tell stories and talk about Sam. But, you know, we have a beautiful daughter. She turns 25 this month and married and living in Orange County. Got the world by the tail on a downhill slope. She thinks life is great. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things to be thankful for. But you can't not go through an experience like that and not have it definitely change and kind of shape who you are, for sure.
But in a sense, I feel like that shaping you, like, has really made you the right chief for this time. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people grieving. There's a lot of people coming out of the pandemic that have reshaped their lives. And as an organization, we went through a lot and a lot of change in the last 4 to 5 years. I've heard you talk a lot about hope. And so I want to ask you how you got to that area of hope after going through all this.
Yeah. So, you know, I have to give a lot of credit to my wife, Lorna. You know, we're people of faith. We have a faith background. That's obviously, that's been impacted heavily by our experience. And that's, you know, maybe a third podcast. you know, I remember the first week that Sam was sick. And, you know, I was telling her that I didn't think that I had the faith that God could heal Sam. And therefore, maybe Sam wouldn't be healed and it'd be my fault, or, you know, just wrestling with, because I'd grown up in the church and, you know, just trying to wrestle with all that. How does this work? And I swear we should put this on a greeting card or something. She looked at me and she says, I don't think faith is believing God will do what we ask. I think faith is believing God will be who he says he is. And, you know, for us, we chose at that moment to embrace hope. And what we meant by hope and what we believe about hope is that hope is active. I am not an optimistic person, and we can debate terminology, optimism versus hope, but I am generally not an optimistic person. People in the chief's office know that if you come to me, I might tell you, no, why we can't do it before I tell you why we can. I tend to be a half-empty kind of guy in terms of just how something probably won't work versus how something will work. Maybe that's 30 years of policing, I don't know. But I don't consider myself to be very optimistic. But I do believe in hope. And hope is a behavior. Behaviors demonstrate our values. And so hope is a behavior that requires action. And I'll give you an example of what that looked like on our journey with Sam and how that applies today. You know, Sam's prognosis at his initial diagnosis was about a 75-80% survival rate. So pretty high survival rate, but not great results from the tumor and the surgery. And then when it came back, it dropped significantly, like 20-25%. And And so now we're in the deep end of the pool trying to figure out what's next, what's this look like, and how do we find additional treatment and new ideas. And doctors at OHSU were amazing, but, you know, nobody's going to fight for your kid like you are going to fight for your kid. So Lorna quit her job as a pediatric occupational therapist and just went all in on the internet, Facebook groups, moms around the country. You know, what can I learn? What can I know? And I was at Central Precinct at the time as a commander, and the way it would work is Sam would go up in the morning for scans or tests, and then I would come up in the afternoon and get the results and everything. And so if we had good news, we'd go get ice cream afterwards. If we had bad news, then Sam and I would drive home in separate cars because he didn't want to see his mom sad. You know, he didn't mind seeing his dad sad, but he didn't want to see his mom sad. So we went up one day and we had bad news, and we're leaving the hospital. And as we're walking out of the doors of Dornbecker's, my wife is on the phone. And I was kind of mad about it. I was kind of frustrated she was on the phone, because normally when we got bad news, we wanted to have some time, the three of us, to kind of digest it. How are we going to tell Natalie? How are we going to tell fam? You know, what's the next step? You know, whatever. And she hangs up the phone and she looks at me and she says, "We need to be in Dallas next week." I'm like, "Dallas, Oregon? What's in Dallas, Oregon? Like, why do we need to be in Dallas?" And she says, "No, Dallas, Texas, next Friday." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And she says, "Well, I've been, you know, anticipating that, you know, this might come about, and I've been talking to these doctors and researchers in Dallas, Texas, and there's a clinical trial that Sam can participate in if we can get down there next week." And, you know, immediately we had hope. And what we mean by that is it's not Pollyannish, it's not delusional, it's not a false hope, but having that to look forward to versus just sitting at home and knowing that the tumors are growing in Sam and there's nothing we could do. And so we flew to Texas. We got into that clinical trial. We flew back and forth to Texas once a month for several months. He had a couple of major surgeries while he was down there. And we would meet with doctors, and doctors would tell us, like, all the bad things. And we would say, "Listen, we're not asking you to cure our son. We're just asking you to be hopeful." Because any day with hope was better than just throwing in the towel and just waiting.
Yeah.
And so that's where that comes from. And that... that applies here, because you're right, Terry. The harm and the loss that the members of this organization experienced in the last couple of years through 2020 and 21, as I watched, certainly as an outsider, but as I watched and knew a little bit from my conversations and relationships, but certainly cannot relate to or understand, but is extremely significant. It's very real. And there's a lot of reasons to be, justifiable reasons to be angry, to be discouraged, to be resentful, whatever those emotions might be. Those are very legitimate and very real. But, you know, speaking of my own experience, particularly going through Sam, you know, I've found that staying angry, operating from a place of anger or resentment, which I have moments of, has never proven to be very effective. I don't make my best decisions when I'm angry. I'm not the most pleasant person to be around. I'm not the most effective when I'm angry. And there's times to be angry. There's absolutely times to be angry. But, you know, choosing to live with hope, but not just like, "Oh, I hope it get better," but like actually trying to move things forward, being proactive in that hope, like Lorna was on that phone call. That's what I want to be about. So when I'm in the chief's office, I know that there's a little bit of eye roll, because I'm always pushing. I always have ideas. I'm always trying to come up with creative solutions. I'm always, and that's because I'm hopeful for this organization. I'm hopeful for this community. It's not because I need the work or I want the work. It's, I feel a sense of responsibility to that value in me that we lived, that gave us some purpose during Sam's sickness, and I want to, you know, continue.
I know that, you know, we all love this city, and, you know, I felt like I used to work for the Tourism Bureau. I couldn't talk about Portland, you know, enough. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I think, have lost a mm-hmm. little of that hope, and mm-hmm. they want the city back. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about your vision. Let's talk about how we're going to move forward, you know, not only in this organization, but how we're going to make an impact on the city.
Yeah. We are uniquely poised, I think, right now as law enforcement, Portland Police Bureau specifically, but really law enforcement in general, to be a leader in this conversation like we haven't seen before. As somebody who was sitting on the sidelines comfortably at home watching all of the impact that was happening, not only our members, but around the country. You know, law enforcement, and understandably so, kind of withdrew from that national conversation because there was no room for it. There was just no place for it. This isn't a blame or a criticism. I think I read somewhere where nearly 50% or more of the major city chiefs, which are the top 80 or so largest agencies in the nation, had chiefs retire, get fired, or quit during that 2021 time period. And Portland was part of that, you know, the changeover between Jamie and Chuck. So, you know, just the uncertainty, the instability, the inconsistency of the profession just sort of being rocked by something that nobody could have seen coming in terms of the perfect storm. And then Portland being like the center of that. I've been all around the country in the last year and a half teaching and leading and giving talks and so forth, and everybody wants to talk about Portland. I mean, Detroit, Denver, Birmingham, Alabama, it doesn't matter. Everybody wants to talk about Portland. Everybody wants to know if it's still on fire. Everybody wants to know how horrible it is. Everybody, you know, I mean, you know, it's amazing the interest and the attention still on Portland. Mm-hmm. So where I'm trying to go, where my hope is I want to leverage right now this desire that I think is shared by a large majority of Portlanders, but really even around the state, to see us be successful, as we mentioned earlier, but to see even public safety be successful. You know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago when city council was taking $27 million away from the Portland Police Bureau budget, right? Mm-hmm. And a week and a half ago, they voted unanimously for 6% premium pay for the new members of the rapid response team. I mean, that's remarkable. That's nothing short, you know. I tell Chuck every day how bad I feel that I get to lead now and he had to lead when he did. But I want to, you know, build upon that, and not in a, you know, selfish, reckless, careless way, but in a genuine way, because I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we're an 1,100 person organization. We're a $260 million budget. We're a big footprint in this town. And Portland's always had what I would call an arm's length love affair with their law enforcement. Like, the city has always historically been very safe. Our numbers reflect that. People have enjoyed a great deal of security and predictability in their lifestyle. And 2020 and 21 and some of 22 kind of blew that all out of the water. And most folks are like, we realize now the role of public safety in our community and the need for it around tourism, around, you know, conferences, around business or whatever it might be. So where I want to go is take some of that hopefulness and really, you know, continue our relationship building with community. Every chief I ever worked for, 12 of them in my first 29 years, said, you know, we need to restore trust. We need trust. We need trust. And I have changed that language to be, I want to change the dynamic between the police and the people we serve. And it's still a desire for that trust and that continued trust building. But I think it's hard to measure trust. It's hard to really know when we've arrived and is it built or is it developed or is it given or is it earned or whatever. So, you know, but the dynamic is that active piece of it, you know, the dynamic about, you know, that relationship that we have. So I really want to continue to emphasize our community relationships. It's critical. We're in this together. It's not the police and the community. We are the community. And I want us to see ourselves as a community. I recognize the role we have is unique in the Portland area, but we really are the community. Second, you know, is talking very candidly and directly about reducing crime and the fear of crime. You know, we have not talked about crime reduction in several years, and we need to talk about that. It's a real thing. It's having an impact on lives. Our laws are meant to provide for a level of predictability. Meaning that when I drove to work this morning down Highway 26, I didn't just pick a random side of the road to drive on and just do whatever I wanted. You know, we drive on the right because we know everybody else is going to be driving the other way on the right, and that allows for me to freely come in on Highway 26 today versus, you know, navigating some kind of chaos. And that's, laws provide that level of predictability. We can have the discussion about the fairness and the application of it, equity, all those things, but the reality is we are a nation of laws, and that accountability and that predictability, I think, is necessary and has been missing. So talking about reducing crime, but also the fear of crime, which is a far greater challenge, because mm-hmm. We cannot not believe our experiences. If you're in pain and I tell you you're not in pain, that's not very helpful. And people have had many negative experiences in the area of crime and public safety. And even if they haven't had that experience personally, they've told others. And so we are in a constant challenge of trying to not only reduce crime, which we're really pretty good at, the numbers are going that direction, but reducing the fear of crime. And we do the reduce the fear of crime by not only focusing on crime reduction numbers, but we do that through our relationships, through, you know, creating new experiences for our officers. That's why I wanted to do the walking beats in the fall. That's why we did the walking beats around the NC2A event. I think we need to create new experience for our officers and new experience for our community to really see each other differently and have a different type of conversation. And then the final piece is really around organizational growth and development. And it'd be easy to say leadership as kind of a broad term there. I think that's a term that gets overused. And when I think of organizational growth and development is that you person may not, a bureau member may not want to be seen as a traditional leader, like a supervisory rank or promoted rank, but they're a leader right where they're at. Every single one of us is leading in some way right where we're at. And it's critical to the success of the organization, regardless of your title or position. And so I really, you know, without a healthy bureau throughout, it doesn't really matter what, you know, my wants and dreams and desires are, because I'm one guy, you know, and the police bureau, I think last year did about 215,000 calls for service, roughly 220, you know, that's 220,000 people we touched. And, you know, that doesn't include the phone calls that come into the, you know, to the front desk or to records or whatever. It doesn't include all the other things that are done, the work that you do in comms and people, you know, the people we're touching on a daily basis in this city is remarkable. So we have a great story to tell. We have a great service to provide. We have an organization to be proud of, but we need to constantly be, and it's heavy on my heart, you know, how do we encourage, support, develop, challenge, hold accountable our members so they can be the best they can be. And that's, you know, those are kind of my three big, you know, big audacious goals that I hope to be able to bring to the organization.
Well, Chief, you're a voracious reader, and I know you can quote all kinds of books. I wish I could remember quotes like you remember. So leave us with something that's impacted you recently, something that you've read.
Yeah, I just finished a book. You know, about how to be seen and see others. It's by David Brooks. He's a columnist for the New York Times. And one of the things he says in there that's given me pause is we perceive the world as we see it, not as it is. And, you know, I've been reflecting on that statement because I can be quick to make judgments. I can be quick to make decisions. And oftentimes in our profession, we're required to do so. But it's given me pause to think, you know, how many times I look at something and see something because that's the way that I want to see it versus the way that it really is. And try to be more curious. Try to be more patient. Another quote that I love is from Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor. And he lost everything, lost his family, you know, obviously thought that he was going to face death in Auschwitz. And in that book, Man's Search for Meaning, he says, you know, between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our growth and our freedom. You know, and here's a guy who's, you know, thinking of this naked, facing what he believes is certain death. His whole family has been killed. I mean, you know, you can't hardly imagine a more dire situation. And he's like, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And so, you know, when I you know, show up, whether it's here or at home or otherwise, I try to remember, okay, what am I doing in that space? And sometimes that space is very, 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 very small. I get it. You know, sometimes there's stimulus and there's response in that space, and that response is required. It's not so much that, you know, there shouldn't be a response, but, you know, is there time in that space, you know, for growth and freedom to be able to think about how I'm going to show up? So, you know, I would just encourage us as an organization. I mean, we're always learning. I am a big advocate of curiosity. I'm a big advocate of trying, you know, new things, thinking outside the box. Obviously, we need to, you know, follow our policies, our laws. You know, those are in place for a reason, the expectations we have. But I would just encourage all of us to, you know, be willing to think differently about how we show up in that space you know, be willing to ask questions of ourselves, be willing to ask questions of one another, and then listen to what we're hearing and, determine, you know, maybe that changes things, maybe it doesn't. I've become a lot more agnostic about things in the sense of trying to put them in a box. This is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad. I definitely have strongly held beliefs about right and wrong and good and bad. But I'm trying to be more more accepting of the fact that two things can be true at the same time, that there can be these conflicting points of view. And I'll kind of end with this example. You know, my wife and I will often go to an event, and then if you talk to us a week later, we'll both be retelling the event, and we'll tell it differently, right? And she remembers things that I don't, and I remember things she doesn't. And if we remember the same thing, chances are we're telling it differently. And that doesn't mean that I'm lying or she's lying, or I'm wrong and she's right, or she's right and I'm wrong. You know, the truth is probably in there, kind of somewhere between mm-hmm. us, right? But going back to, you know, we perceive the world as we see it, not as it is. And so, you know, the ability to kind of hold both of those and realize, like, you know, maybe as an individual we disagree on some things, but, you know, more or less we're trying to find some understanding, not necessarily agreement, but some understanding that will allow us to move forward. I've found that to be much more beneficial than just, you know, I'm right, you're wrong. Let's move on. So that's the approach I'm trying to take. It's not always successful, but we'll see. But that would be my encouragement to others as well.
Well, thanks for coming on. We might have you on again.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Talking Beat. Do you have a question for us? You can call and leave a message on our dedicated voicemail line. The number is 971-339-8868. Or send us an email to talkingbeat@police.portlandoregon.gov. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends. More episodes can be found at our website, www.portland.gov/police/podcast.